While the old schools of architecture churn out the same old boxes, climate change is going to demand a complete revolution in the way buildings are planned and where they're sited. Now here we have Sue Rofe, the Professor of Sustainable Architecture at Oxford Brookes University, speaking on building cities and climate change at the Climate Change Conference held on June 3, 2006. It was organized by the Campaign for Climate Change at www.campaigncc.org.
Right. How many architects do we have here today? Hands up. One. Engineers? A couple. And... Any local councillors? Yeah. Right. Okay. And generally from a range of interested backgrounds, I presume here. Today we'd like to talk about the importance of buildings in the climate change equation. And you can see here that what Lovelock calls man the virus, spreading across the surface of the earth, is reflected in the location of buildings and the use of energy in those buildings. In this wonderful diagram, we do apologise for the colour, by the way. And what we're all here about, and what we're all deeply concerned about, is this issue where sustainability is no longer this very cosy little issue of some comfortable, you know, yogurt and knitted socks and things. We're beginning to realise it's simply about survival. And this increasingly obvious fact that we only have one planet, we only have one planet full of resources, and that planet is being changed fast with the issues of the rapidly changing climate, 2, 3, 4 degrees centigrade increase in temperature predicted over the next 50 to 80 years. And a lot of this, and you can see here with the top line, the black line, the total increase in man-made CO2 emissions is rising so fast in the last 50 years, driving a very, very worrying change in the climate. And so what we saw up until really, perhaps even 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago, as potentially a natural variation in the climate, is increasingly being seen as an exponential growth. And one that we realise through our modelling that we can intervene on to decrease total emissions and change the decrease the impacts of our occupation of this planet. And here you see the dots representing the annual temperature trends, going up to a degree centigrade temperature with the big dots of the warming over the continents and the oceans. And where you see the continental impact, Western Europe seems to be being badly affected, as is the Midwest of America and also South Africa and Australia. And the oceans warming. We know from what we see on the news and so on that the glaciers are retreating in Patagonia and the ice caps are going and the North Sea, the Arctic is being eaten away at. And you can see the red represents what the Arctic was in 1979. The black represents what the Arctic was in 1979, and you can see what it is. That's 2003. These rapid changes, and you can see Greenland there with the land ice, because of course this is sea ice, which doesn't really make a difference to sea levels. But it's the land ice, like the Antarctic and Greenland. And if the polar ice melts with if the Greenland ice cap melts, we're looking at about a 7 meter rise in sea level. And we're also looking at the massive reliefs of carbons from rainforest, savanna, grasslands, methane from permafrost and thermohaline disruption. So what does this mean for buildings and cities? Well, we're beginning to get an inkling. This is how much of Florida you lose with a 1 meter rise in sea level, which is possibly predicted within 100 years at the current rates of warming. What happens if all the ice melts, if the Antarctic, the Arctic, if runaway climate change happens? We're looking at a 70 to 100 meter rise in sea levels. And something like 80% of the world's great cities, the big cities, are within about a kilometre of the sea. Look at the population, look at the economic losses of those major sea level rises. And even with the 1 metre sea level rise, this is 70 metre rise in sea level. And the trouble is we're sort of inured from it. And when we saw this great movie, you know, The Day After Tomorrow, there's this feeling as the water rolls in over the Statue of Liberty that it will never happen. And you know, really, we're beginning to see that, in fact, it is happening. And it will increasingly happen. Here's New Orleans. You know, the end of the world as we know it. What are they doing now? Rebuilding New Orleans. And this warming ocean, which is driving this, it's not just a one-off. Here's the hurricane tracks in 1944 to 2004. This is category 3 to 5, and these are the tracks of those. That's up to this is 1995 tracks to 2004. And this is what's happened in the last 10 years. Oh, God, you can hardly see it. Sorry about that. But just a frenzy of new hurricanes and so on, and impacts that are devastating. And what did this remind me of? I thought 1953, Canvey Island. And here's a man laughing hysterically over here. He lives on Canvey Island. We had a fireman from Oxford went down there, still lives in Oxford, for 1953. And it's the same thing. They cut them out of the bungalow roofs dead, because they didn't have the windows to get out the roofs. That's what they did, you know, tens, hundreds in New Orleans. You can't get out if the water rises suddenly and you're in the roof and you can't. But is anywhere safe today? I don't know. And so we're talking about death in buildings there. And this is all about, because we all spend 90 to 95% of our percent of our lives in buildings. Can you see that one? Yes, you can really. This shows the dark areas in France. 2003, the summer, this is the area of France where up to 10 degrees centigrade difference, anomaly in the difference between the same week in July 2001 and July 2003. What happened? It was actually about 35,000 people died in a week. And it was 15,000 in France. You can see why here. And that was in the ordinary traditional buildings. So buildings are no longer giving us the types of security that we thought. And here you can see on this graph, there was this absolute blip, summer 2003, right at the top. And that's the type of temperatures we're going to be getting every second year by 2050. Yeah? Hey, we're all right, Jack. We live in sensible Europe. What happens if you live in a shoebox in the middle of California or Arizona or Texas? And Fergus is going to be dealing with this later. And try and see what you can see. The thing about climate change in buildings, and I'm not talking about them, or how do we house them, it's about where you live. How safe will you be? And you look at it, the risk issue is about hazard. How bad is it? How close do you live to the sea level? Yeah. How close do you live to the bottom of a valley that's going to flash flood or something? The extent of the hazard is key, how exposed you are to that hazard, and how vulnerable you are. In 2003, in France, it was the elderly who died. You know, some of the young, the vulnerable, the ill. And these are the types of issues now. This is interesting, 1932 this was written. This is the areas of the world where you can, white man, whitey, this is S.F. Markham, a geographical determinist, said, you see all the black bits, that's the places around the world where you can live comfortably without too much heating, without too much cooling. And all that bit in the middle, the hot bit, is where S.F. Markham thought, with the joys of air conditioning, we could take white man's politics and gods and economy into areas they couldn't occupy without being degraded. So that shows you how very fragile. If you add the climate change, 2, 3, 4 degrees centigrade, see how much of the world is going to be safe in 20, 30 years' time. Because you see, before, and Fergus again will deal with this, we could always buy our way out of the problem. Why are we living in Phoenix, Arizona? It's because we can. Because energy was cheap. And hello, we all know about the peak oil issue, I'm sure. The idea that we have this small window of cheap energy, but the states, why were they so worried? They peaked in their energy outputs in 1972, and you can see how they're rapidly trailing off. And here you can see the global peak, and if you see conventional oil, which is the second one down, the yellow one, this is the issue. This is the best estimates we have from Boyle and Bentley on the point of peak. And it looks for near as damn it as if we just passed peak, which means that the price of energy, as we rapidly decline in our outputs of oil and gas globally, and global in demand to drive buildings and cities, goes exponentially up. That's the economic problems that we're facing in the future. And if you don't think we've got a problem already, the systems are already on the verge of collapse. New York, August 2003, one of the hottest days of the year, 50 million people down in a 24 to 48 hour blackout. What did they do? They had to crawl out of these buildings. There's no lights on. There's no air conditioning. They're all fixed windows. You've got about half an hour to get out of one of those buildings before you are seriously challenged with your health. What did they do? Brave New Yorkers, post 9/11, they went out and slept on the streets, nobody robbed from each other. What happens if that goes down? You get the human failure, or the transformer goes when it's a snowstorm or a blizzard. Where do those 50 million people go if they can't stay in the buildings? You know, we're looking at systems on the verge of catastrophic collapse. And Britain, hello, Britain at the end of the pipeline. This is DTI, our government. And you see the brighter yellow. We will just about run out of oil and gas by 2020. How do we run our buildings? But not only is how do we run them, we obviously buy in gas if the Russians want to sell it to us, if they're our friends that week. And I mean, this is predicted, this is 10 years old now. Slide blackouts, we're through the blackouts. We're right into the age of who knows what? We really don't know what will happen. All we know is that you yourself as already individuals are beginning to think about how you can make yourself safe, how you can survive in your house, in your village, you know, in your whatever. We're beginning to think about it. It's beginning to worry us. Petrol prices, yeah. But what about the people who live in San Paolo, the ones who are rioting in the high-rise buildings, who can't afford the energy to run those buildings? I mean, the thing about buildings is that buildings use actually about over half of all the CO2 energy we use in the world. They're responsible for well over half of the CO2 emissions globally. Buildings are right in the middle of it. Buildings, you see, right up there. And a lot of that electricity generation, residential and commercial, about a quarter of the world's emissions come from houses, and these are the emissions that are escalating and rocketing. And what are we doing about it? Well, we are building in China a new coal power station a week. We've got dreams of cities that could have come out of Captain Fantastic in the 1930s comics. We're building a paradigm that not only is not sustainable, but it's killing the planet too. And people say, you hear this again and again, wow, China's the big problem. But per capita, the emissions in the USA, look at the difference between the Chinese per capita and the USA per capita emissions. So where's the problem? Who will really die first? And we've got Audrey Mayer this afternoon talking about contraction and convergence. The idea that, wow, look, here we are at Kyoto. If we want to survive, if we want to stabilise climate, we have to make massive reductions. And we have to, the latest Institute for Public Policy Research means that we have to reduce by 90% by 2050. to avoid dangerous emissions from our lifestyles and buildings. But it's very odd, really, because for millennia, thousands of years, we've lived without energy. And it was really the 1930s, 40s, 50s, where the built on cheap energy, cheap electricity, really, that the vernacular from the Antarctic to the deserts of the tropics suddenly became this new type of building. And you see here, this lower one, if you get the completely air-conditioned old glass box, like you're seeing mushrooming all over London, they're letting them through. And if you see this second from the top, good practice number one, that was the traditional old London office block. Yeah? And every year we're getting more and more glass boxy. And if you add some renewable energy to the naturally ventilated heavyweight office building, you can get right down to the zero, category zero. And those buildings don't even touch on what architects consider to be sexy. You know, hey, it's pointy, it's shiny, it's blobby. And these are nightmares. These are environmental nightmares. And they win the gold awards. They win the Palm d'Or year after year. This is what RIBA thinks is pushing the envelope. Now, I know from my house, this is an ordinary house in Oxford, I think 11 years ago, first photovoltaic roof in the UK, yada, yada, yada. You can get right down in an ordinary house with energy efficiency, 50, 60%. You can then get down another 10%, 20%, 30% by putting solar energy. So this house already uses 90%, over 90% less energy. I mean, my quarterly gas bill for the November quarter for a six-bedroom house, £9.50. I mean, is this clever or what? It's just ordinary. Why aren't the developers being made by law to do that? No, we still have this dream of this. You know, who wants to spend their summer holiday in the business district of Frankfurt? Hateful buildings, people loathe them, and they just get being produced by the system. Nations can do things. You know, Germany, we're going solar. We've got a huge amount in the large scale. There are solutions, renewable energy programs. We have the technology, solar air conditioning. But fundamentally, at the heart of why we are the roots of path of procurement is that while we can do all that, we're not. I mean, again, you say the RIBA, the architects love big shiny things because they are no longer known. They're not taught in the schools of architecture how to make a low energy building. They are taught to design blobs, big glass boxes. And that's what they're told is sexy. The engineers are paid according to how much air conditioning equipment they put into a building. Where's the logic in that? The estate agents get paid according to how big and shiny a building is. They get higher rents for big shiny buildings. If it's air conditioned, they get double the lease rent. The whole system is designed to protect business as usual. And at the heart of it, things have got to change. Where are we going to find the power to change new paradigms? Maybe cities, maybe states. You know, America, they say it's so bad, we've seen the thing. A lot of American states, California wants to cut by 20%, they want to introduce 20% renewables by 2010, again and again. Cities, 273 cities around the states now have signed up to Kyoto. We have to start not rejecting or not working with big government, start with small government, individuals, vested interests. In Oxford, we go out into the streets, we sell solar systems to people, we give them cheap offers, we try and make them safe in their own homes, and we put solar hot water systems on the pensioners' bungalows, free. We give them free insulation. We try and help the vulnerable be safer, because the system can work for you as well as against you. And we look at all the individual houses, we give them, try to facilitate them being safe in their homes. And in return, the ordinary people of Oxford are buying these systems, are trying to make a difference. That we've got people who want to make solar streets in Oxford, you know. There are systems that do work. Solar cities, cities around the world are coming together to make a difference. China, they say it's the problem. Look at the Chinese Revolution, Australia, Copenhagen. We know how to count, we know how to design cities. Dundee, they're just putting in a new photovoltaic plant. Again, they've got whole programs in solar cities. We've got new technologies. We've got different ways of looking at buildings. This is the theory. If you go to the ordinary architecture school, they're doing none of this. They're not even teaching technology in many schools. Why? Where's the denial? Why doesn't somebody stand up and point the finger and say, you are responsible for the future of this planet. Why not behave responsibly? They like a few stick-ons, you know. There is some change. If they think it's sexy, then, you know, they're going to go with the flow. But fundamentally, you don't stick a solar panel on a profligate building. You have to change the paradigm. Go right down to category naught from the big one. And, you know, things are happening. But someone like Bill Dunster, knocking on the door for how long? How much change do you get? In China, we're having massive revolutions. 76% of the world's solar energy is being produced by men such as these in their massive solar plants with huge investments. He's got Huan Ming, who runs this, is one of the 10 richest men in China now. He's got 760 franchises for his solar business, and they're putting solar all over China. And why aren't we doing it in the UK? Why aren't we doing it in Europe? Perhaps China will lead the way in their buildings, in their cities. So all the streetlights there run on solar. So there are solutions. I love his solar car, is that you? Sweet, I want one. New heat pump technologies. And just to show you, not only do we have the technology, we have the dreams, we have the visions, and we have the financial benefits to incorporate low carbon technologies into a low carbon economy. And we need to do it because cities, the paradigm for cities has to be fundamentally changed if we are to survive. And I'll finish this quite quickly and pass over to Fergus. Lots of issues in buildings. Lots of ways of rethinking cities, reusing waste, reusing pollution. Reorganizing the way we live. Will it happen? We don't really know yet, but what I will say is what's keeping us all back are the lies, the misinformation, the denial. We have the technologies. This is Don Town, just near Shanghai. You see that large island? Arabs, the best engineers in the world, they're taking that island. They're building a new Don Town solar city, long-term vision, sustainable cities. Only it's about a meter above sea level, behind levees. I mean, wake up, smell the coffins. Unless we have some joined up thinking, that'll be downtown, like New Orleans, like London, Tokyo, New York. Can we change what we're doing? Some people say we've got 10 years to change. Can you imagine the enormity of changing cities? And this is the World Wildlife Fund. Create the evidence base. We're trying to do that. Create new visions, new futures. How do we change the cities? And we're working on this and determine the action plans for cities and buildings. We're working on this. We've got 10 years. Will it happen? I don't know. Because there are enormous vested interests in ensuring it doesn't happen. And I'll pass over to Fergus to tell you about one of the biggest vested interests of all.
That was Susan Roaf, spelled R-O-A-F, a professor of sustainable architecture at Oxford Brookes University, speaking on building cities and climate change at a conference held on June 3, 2006, and organized by www.campaignCC.org.